Art Walk, co-sponsored by Crew FM.
You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered radio powered by the sun here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, broadcasting live from the Cultural District on this beautiful early September 2016 day.
Yeah,
and
it's a beauty.
This is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. How are you today, Mom?
I'm good. It's a beautiful day. How could I be otherwise?
Well, today we have a wonderful guest, and it really worked out well to have him join us in the studio today. Originally, I was going to be out of town today, and I had scheduled a recording to air right. today. And then last Sunday, we were at our friend Jim Bella Love's birthday party, and part of his party, he was playing a slideshow of some of the things that he has done in the past year, which included some really amazing travel with Captain Jerry Yellen, who is our guest today. And he said, Jerry's coming back to town. He'll be here this weekend. Yeah. I said, well, why don't we bring him back on the show? We've had him on the show before, but over the phone, never in person. Now, Captain Jerry Yellen was an Army Air Corps veteran who served in World War II between 1941 and 45. He enlisted 2 months after the bombing of Pearl Harbor on his 18th birthday. And after the war ended, Jerry struggled with severe undiagnosed PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And out of that came the books that he wrote, I think, and he's now the author of 4 books, Of War and Weddings, The Blackened Canteen, The Resilient Warrior, and The Letter. And right now, Jerry's here in Fairfield working on a film project on one of those books. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Jerry.
Well, I'm not working on a film project. I'm the subject of a film project, and they're keeping me exclusively out of the meetings that they're having. I haven't seen very much of the film, just a little promo, but it's good to be back in Fairfield. I left for good in October last year after my wife, Helene, passed away in June of 2015.
And how long had you lived in Fairfield?
I was here about 25 years, lived in Fairfield by choice. I came here to see my son, Stephen, who was working for the university, and my wife and I decided we wanted to become part of the community. While I was here, of course, you know, post-traumatic stress was a big part of my life for 30 years and until 1975, when Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was on the Merv Griffin show, and my wife saw that show and decided to learn TM. And she did in June or July of 1975. And I learned in August of 1975. And I really got my life back. My life began then. My book career began actually in 1983, when I was asked by the Mitsui Bank to come to Japan to help them understand the American real estate market, I was a consultant to the Bank of California, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America in their real estate loans. And I looked at the man, the vice chairman of the Mitsui Bank, and I looked at him as a Japanese man, my enemy, deep hatred for them then. And I said, I can't go. I'm too busy. And I went home that night, and I said, Helene, I just turned down a trip to Japan. And she looked at me and said, Jerry, you never once asked me if I wanted to go to Japan. So in October 1983, I went to the homeland of my enemy, and I was there for 16 days and just blown away with what I learned and what I saw, that they weren't the ferocious, vicious, evil people that I had learned that they were, so that I could hate them and kill them. Mm-hmm. And that the culture and the food and the language was difficult, but the culture and the food were very acceptable. The scenery was beautiful. The people were just splendid. And on the last night that we were in Japan, Helene said to me that Robert, who was our fourth son, a senior at San Diego State University, would love Japan. Let's give him a graduation present. And I said, fine. So in 1984, when Robert graduated from college, he went to Japan for 6 weeks, came home, didn't know what he wanted to do, and decided to teach English. He signed a contract in 1984 to teach English for 1 year.
In Japan?
In Japan. Wow. At an English after English school. And now it's 2016, 32 years later, he hasn't come back yet. So, obviously, he likes Japan. 1987, we talked, and he said, you pay for the tickets and come over, and I'll take care of you. I want to take you on a trip in Japan. So Helene and I went in 1987. And while we were there, we met a young lady by the name of Takako Yamakawa. And the last night that we were there, Robert said that he and Takako wanted to get married. It struck me very, very hard. I immediately saw a flashback in my head of pictures and voices and sights of the 16 young guys that I flew with in World War II who were killed. Five guys training to fly planes and 11 guys killed in combat, literally over Japan. But I had a thought behind that, that it's Robert's life, not my life, that's important. But I was curious, and I said, what does her father say? And he said, her father won't meet me.
Mm.
Wow. 7 months later, Mr. Yamakawa came with two of his older sons. Robert came with his intended fiance. The two brothers just grilled Robert mercilessly about his religion, his ability to make money, his education, and made him promise out loud, loud and clear, that if the wedding took place, he would never, ever move their sister back to America, away from their family, which he did.
Wow.
And then the father spoke, and he asked my son five questions. Was your dad in the war? Yes. How old is he? 63. What did he do? He was a pilot. What did he fly? P-51s. Where? Over Japan. And that broke up the wedding.
Oh.
Takako was upset. Robert was upset. And Mr. Yamakawa went home and said to his wife, make the wedding. And she went ballistic. He said, for 43 years, you've been telling me how much you hate the Americans, that you went to China and never fired a bullet against the Americans. You didn't die for your country. You didn't die for your emperor. And now you want our daughter to marry this guy, Gene, this foreigner? And he said, yes. And she said, why? And he said, any man that could fly a P-51 against the Japanese and live must be a brave man, and I want the blood of that man to flow through the veins of our grandchildren.
Wow.
So on March 5th, 2 days shy of 43 years to the day that I landed on Japanese soil on Iwo Jima, March 7th, 1945. I watched my son get married in a Japanese shrine, the Mishima Shrine in Mishima, Japan, dressed as a Japanese warrior to a Japanese woman. And that was the beginning of my writing career, because nobody in my family knew more than the fact that I was a P-51 pilot. That's all I ever knew. Mm. And I had memories to share. And when I came home from that wedding, I started to write. Mm. And that book was called Of War and Weddings. Didn't get published till 1990 or 1992 from a company in Fairfield, then First World Publishing,
right,
now World Library. And it was a catharsis for me. And it was an eye-opening experience for the people in my family who read it. They never knew anything about my life.
Why do you think you had been so hesitant to talk to them about it before?
Why do I think what?
Why were you so hesitant to talk to them about it before?
When you put a uniform on, first off, I was raised not to kill. Thou shalt not kill. You can't kill anything. I have a friend, Woody Williams, who's the last surviving Medal of Honor winner from the Iwo Jima battle. And he says, I was raised on a farm in West Virginia, and you didn't kill anything unless it was to eat it or to take it out of its misery. And I had to learn to hate an enemy, because if I didn't hate them and kill them, they were going to kill me. So you put a uniform on and you figure out quickly that you're ready to give your life to protect the guys that are around you. They're willing to give their lives to protect you. And then you learn how to use a weapon to kill other human beings.
Wow.
And I did that. And there's no one learning once you've killed somebody. There's no changing that, and it's a devastating feeling. We have veterans today from the 23 cumulative years of Iraq and Afghanistan, young veterans committing suicide at a rate of 22 every day that is known.
Oh my God.
From the killing that they did.
Wow.
And I could never speak about it. My own experiences where I didn't sleep at night. I thought about suicide. I thought about and spoke to and saw and visualized the 16 guys that I flew with. And I wasn't addicted to drugs and I wasn't addicted to alcohol, but I couldn't work. I couldn't keep a job. We moved 15 or 16 times in our early married life. And I was not a human being, not a decent guy. I was all about, how can I get rid of this stress? What's going on in my life? And TM did that for me. Transcendental Meditation did it for me. When Robert got married, it opened my eyes up to the fact that all of us are human beings, all of us, and that people who are willing to kill other people for what they believe are evil. When I was 12 years old in 1936, I read about race problems, religious problems, terrorist problems, the beginning of the German conquest of their part of the world and the killing of Jews and gypsies and indigent people. And now it's 2016, 80 years later, I'm reading the same headlines, exactly the same. And when I wrote Of War and Weddings, it was a catharsis for me. Every name came back, every incident came back. I saw all the words in my head, and all I had to do was put them on paper. And I did that. I went on a book tour in 1992, 1993, across the country. I spoke to a lot of people about TM, about post-traumatic stress, about killing. Whether it had any effect on anybody, I don't know.
But I'm sure it did.
Transcendental meditation today is $1,000 for a veteran. And it certainly beats the $8 billion a month that the veteran is spending just for antipsychotic and antidepressant drugs, which are addictive and more harmful than they do good. And that $8 billion is going to get a larger, to be a larger number, and go on for 600 or 700 months. And it's all about money.
Wow.
For the drug industry.
Well, just you would think that the Veterans Administration, they know what they know about TM and what it can do, right?
Everybody knows about TM. My life and the life of my generation differs from the generations of today.
Mm-hmm.
We were all products of the Depression. I was born in 1924. Mm-hmm. When I was 5 years old, the Depression came in 1929. I remember it very well. And life was about you. You tried to help other people. They tried to help you. And today, seemingly, life is about me only, not about you.
Yeah.
There are religious people who are anti-TM because they just believe in what they believe, and that if you just pray, all your problems will be taken care of. And TM is not a religion. There's no religious thoughts. You don't have to change your mind or change your clothes. Just learn a technique of how to get into deep silence and remove stress from your mind and your body. That's all it is, and it works. And then there's the money angle. A lot of people make a lot of money. And Congress, to me, is controlled by the pharmaceutical industry, by the gun industry. We could do something about the guns. We could give everybody in America a gun, let them have a gun, but outlaw bullets, because it isn't the gun that kills people.
Oh,
it's the bullets. It's just outlaw the bullets. If
that's
they want
right.
to sell guns, that's fine.
Right.
Just don't shoot anybody with
don't,
it.
You can shoot at somebody, but you don't have anything to the gun.
Wow.
To shoot. So we can do that, but it's about money. And life is not about money. Life is about living and doing for other people.
Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jerry Yellen, author of 4 books, including Of War and Weddings and The Blackened Canteen. Now, this film that is being made.
I met a lady
you.
In Fairfield who was an honor graduate of a documentary school in New York City in the swimming pool, run every day in the swimming pool, Louisa Marino. And she said that I would like to make a documentary about your life. Flattering, humbling. We've made some big trips together to Japan. She's met my family. She has 2 people here in Fairfield, Melissa from New York City, and Liz, meeting with Jim Belalove at Creative Edge now for 3 or 4 days to talk about the marketing and the production, taking all the film that she has, hundreds and hundreds of hours.
So it's all been filmed already?
It's being put together now.
Being when edited, it, yeah.
When it's going to be done is unknown to me. What it's about me, I don't really know. I've just done all of the things that they've asked me to do. And it's a very humbling experience to think that your life is worthy of a story to be told by other people.
Yeah.
I was on Iwo Jima in 2015 at the age of 91, and I was interviewed by the Department of Events of Veteran Affairs Video, Department of Defense Video. A 5-minute video is on YouTube. That's been hit 25 or 26 million times.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Wow.
You're famous.
And PBS, Arnold Shapiro and Cal Scobie were hired by Japanese public television to make a documentary, a three-hour documentary for them in Japan, which they did. They took a, got permission to release a 55-minute video, which you can see bits of at my website, CaptainJerryEllen.com. But that was put into a film called Iwo Jima, From Combat to Comrades, and released in 2015. It's available on PBS.org, Iwo Jima, From Combat to Comrades.
So is that about the healing,
Not about the healings, in per se about transcendental meditation. It's about the only battle ever fought fiercely. 8 square miles of land, Iwo Jima, 8 square miles of land, 90,000 soldiers fighting on 8 square miles of land, 28,000 bodies rotting in the sun.
So was that the only land battle between American and
between
Japanese?
Between America and Japan.
Wow.
This is a province of Tokyo. It's the Japanese soil. And General Snowden, who was a captain on Iwo Jima, is in it. Woody Williams, the last surviving 27 winners of the Medal of Honor in 36 days by the Marines in that battle. And I am in it. I think I'm in it because of my Japanese grandchildren and what happened with Robert, but I did fly and fight off of Iwo Jima. And a man by the name, a Japanese man by the name of Akokusa, who had a pistol, a gun by a Marine aimed at his head, and an Army guy came and took the gun away from the Marine. And Mr. Akokusa says, "I was not captured, I was rescued by an American man." And the four of us are the principals in that film.
Wow.
Iwo Jima. So there's been a lot of beneficial gifts to me. I was in Logan Air Force Base last week speaking to the graduates of the flight school. The week before, I was in Midland, Texas, speaking to the people who raise dogs for freedom. These are dogs that take a year to train to help veterans for suffering from post-traumatic stress. Mm. The week before, I was in Washington, D.C. I laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and I speak to people. They get a little bit of me, a little bit of what I can give to them, but I get feedback from every person that I talk to that's in the audience that listens to my speech. And I'm much more the beneficiary of from them than I can ever give out of myself to them. So life to me is go to Florida, swim a few days, get in a plane and fly away.
So are you living in Florida when you're...
I live at Exit 58, Champions Gate, Exit 58 on Route 4 between Orlando and Tampa with my son Stephen. He had the condominium, and he granted me the gift of living with him for the rest of my life.
Now, when you were, this is kind of off the subject, but when you were in Fairfield, did you have something to do with the founding of a company here?
I did. Yeah. I met in a heated discussion one day with a man by the name of Lance Yettersberger, who I felt had done something that wasn't quite the right thing to another friend of mine. I was 70 years old. This was 22 years ago. And he said to himself, "I got to get a hold of this feisty guy and get involved with him." So I joined Lisco as a marketing person, and I had certain goals. And if I reached those goals, I would be a stockholder in Lisco. So I did that and became a stockholder in Lisco, local internet service company. The company then was called Dome Systems. I think Lance had 40 or 50 dial-up customers. And I said to him, "Lance, you can't go out and sell Dome Systems in Iowa. That they're going to connect it to the Maharishi and they're not going to go for it." He said,
right.
"Well, what should I name it? What should we name it?" I said, let me think about it. Well, you know, in meditation, a lot of good things happen. And it came to me that every newspaper, every small town in Iowa had his newspaper. And we needed a place to put the equipment. And if we called it the local internet service company, they could advertise. We'd give them the equipment and let them have free access to the internet for their employees. And they would give us the free advertising for their local internet service company, mm-hmm. which is Lisco. That's how the name came about.
Yeah, I think I was one of Lisco's first 100 customers.
Well, it was very interesting.
I'm pretty
times.
Sure.
And Lance was a Canadian then. He tells me that he became an American citizen because he liked my story. And so that's a flattering thing, too, and we're dear friends.
So at some point you retired from that. At some point you retired from Lisco.
I sort of didn't have much to do anymore, and I took a lot more time off than they wanted me to take off. I went to Florida for the winters, and they all stayed here and felt the winter, and they sort of asked me if I would stop working.
Oh, but you haven't. You've kept working.
It was not unexpected. But I'm 92 years old now. You know,
Well, it sounds to me like you're still working, but just not on that.
I'm not working.
Not on that. But
I am enjoying my life. I live my life actually the way the banker looks at my checking account. Yesterday's a canceled check, that's gone. Today's money in the bank, you can spend it. And tomorrow's a promissory note, you don't know if you're going to get there tomorrow.
Right,
yeah.
So this is the way I approach my life. But I'm booked to be the speaker at the Air Force Academy in Colorado on the 70th anniversary of the formation of the Air Force, September 18th, 2017. I'm booked to go to a school, a camping school in La Porte, Minnesota, in Indiana in June of 2017. I'm booked through to be in Honolulu and speak on the Missouri about the Blackened Canteen. Dr. Sagana will be there, and the Pacific Air Museum will be there, and we're going to have a memorial service in Honolulu of the 75th anniversary of the beginning of World War II, that's December 7th, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor. And that's an interesting story because they call people my age, the greatest generation. Tom Brokaw wrote a book called The Greatest Generation. I refute that in some ways because the MacArthur, General MacArthur, the General Marshall, the Admiral King, Admiral Nimitz, all of these folks were college education, academy graduates, and it was their decision not to occupy Germany, Japan, and Italy, but to rebuild those three countries into democracies with American money and American ingenuity. And they did that. And the two countries that we fought seriously with as allies in World War II, China and Russia, seemingly today, are the enemies of the world. So the people we fought with are our enemies, and the people we fought against are our friends and allies. And that's in my lifetime. The only difference that I see between World War II and pre-World War II, and today, 2016, is the science of the military. Science has brought us to the position of having nuclear warfare. And we've seen what atomic warfare does. But nuclear warfare, if it ever starts, has the ability to destroy our planet, Earth's abilities to sustain life, all life. And it could make this planet a dead planet. And I believe, quite firmly believe, that America is the only country that can prevent nuclear war, America. And our Congress doesn't quite see it that way. And they're not funding the necessary funds to maintain the Air Force's need for pilots, now 700, next year 1,500, beyond that 4,000 or 5,000 more pilots. And the Congress of today has not done their job. It's interesting times.
So you're saying that we need to expand the military?
We have to maintain the Air Force.
Maintain. Okay, yeah. So those pilots are needed just to replace the ones
that are...
Those
pilots are just maintained because
of retirement.
Pilots, number one, leaving their jobs and their commitment to the Air Force for more money, flying for the airlines. The airlines have needs for 5,000 or 6,000 or 8,000 pilots a year.
Wow.
No one.
Did you ever consider flying for an airline?
I'm sorry?
Did you ever consider flying for an airline?
I did fly for
you
the airline.
You did fly for the airline?
I flew for a non-scheduled airline called Trans-Caribbean Airlines. It was a C-47, a DC-3. Now, the only comparison I can make about a fighter pilot who has the freedom of the skies and speed and the ability to do anything he wants and then get into an airplane and fly 7 hours from Newark to Miami and to do box lunches for the passengers and put fires out for those flying from Puerto Rico because they're cooking chickens in the back of a C-47 is to take an Indy 500 driver in one of those fast cars and put him in a Greyhound bus in New York and say, drive to Los Angeles. He's not going to last very long either.
No.
So I lasted 6 or 7 months as a commercial pilot. Oh. It wasn't fun for me. But I stopped flying military airplanes as well, because I knew if I continued to fly when I was 23, 24, 25 years old, that I was going to die either by chance or by choice. And I didn't want to die. I wanted to live. Mm. And it was transcendental meditation that literally gave me my life that I have today. Twice a day, every day, deep silence. Mm. And wonderful thoughts that come to you in your meditation, creative thoughts and good thoughts that you can pass on to other people.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our wonderful, distinguished guest today is Jerry Yellen, author of The Blackened Canteen, among other books. Do you think you'll write any more books?
I have a book in mind. I have a title for it. God is Jewish. I'm not a believer in God because I don't think that there's such a thing as an omnipotent, omnipresent person that would allow the destruction of people in his image the way it goes on today. But the title God is Jewish is in part humorous and in part real, because a whole religion is built on the fact that the King of the Jews was his son. A young Jewish man by the name of Yeshua ben Yosef, Joshua son of Joseph, became known as Yeshua HaMashiach, which means Joshua the enlightened man, which in Aramaic or Greek is Jesus the Christ, and he was from a Jewish family. So I have a book in mind. I don't know if it'll ever get written, but I like the idea of it, of the writing. I like to write.
At what age did you start writing?
I started writing in 1988. I was born in 1924, so I guess I was 64 years old.
64. And you've had quite a successful career writing. Did you always want to write a book?
When I wrote Of War and Weddings, I had a 64K floppy disk K-Pro computer that weighed 50 pounds.
I wrote
the whole night through, and I went to print it out, and the printer connection was just a little too far away, and I moved the computer, and the plug came out, and I lost everything because I had forgotten to save it. 64K. And I was Oh, I was angry at myself, big time, beat up myself. But when I looked at what I write, I didn't know how to spell. I didn't know how to write sentences together, put the thoughts down. They were in my head and they came out. I became a writer.
How did you learn? Words. How did you learn to write? How did you learn to write? What made you, how did you get better?
I just wrote. That's how I learned to write. And I looked at what I wrote in astonishment mostly. Where did that come from? Because for me, the words were all there. The scenes were there. I just had to find words to describe the scenes that were in my head. And the writing just came as a physical entity after the scenes. And that's the way I write. That's the way I did write. I've experienced what I've written. And it's the description of my experiences. But everybody has a story that they can write. It's their own story. Yeah. All I have to do is sit down and tell their story.
Yeah.
All the stories are interesting, some more than others. And writing is a beautiful way of expression.
Mom started a writer's group at her church for people to just learn to write.
I have to tell you that when I was younger, I became a fan of an elderly woman who was known as Grandma Moses.
Oh, I remember her.
Who was an artist and became an artist in her 70s or 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, I'm going to do something like that. I'm not doing anything now that's worthwhile. But I'm going to do something decent and worthwhile when I get to be older. And I think I fulfilled that to myself, that I'm a decent human being. I care about other people. I don't want money for what I do. I don't want to get paid. I don't have a need for dollars in my pocket or in my bank account, but I do need expenses for travel, and that's the way I travel. I also have two fallback people that I can call if I need expenses, and they're willing to do that, and they never say no to me, so I never ask them.
Oh.
They just don't say no. And that's a beautiful feeling to have for me.
So you're really saying it's never too late to start doing something new, something creative, expressing yourself.
When I was preparing to be bar mitzvah in 1936, preparing for my 13th birthday, February 1937, I hated every minute of it. I didn't know what I was doing and why I was doing it. But my mother was a big reader. And when she finished the library book, I read it. And when I was preparing, learning Hebrew, I read a book called The Magnificent Obsession by a Presbyterian minister, Lloyd C. Douglas, The Magnificent Obsession. And it's the story of a small town on Lake George in New York, maybe 200 or 300 people, and a beloved doctor, Dr. Hudson, in his late 60s, is having a heart attack, and the sky and the sun, a 20-year-old, 21-year-old son of the richest person in the territory, maybe in all of New York, is drowning, and the fire department has one resuscitator, and they choose to use it on the young man, and Dr. Hudson dies. And 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people, strangers, come to his funeral in this little town, each one bearing a gift, and his family couldn't understand it. And in his possessions, they found a journal in code, and they had someone decode it. And the opening lines of his journal was, "Do something good for someone else every day of your life, and don't tell anyone what you've done, because when you talk about it, you use up the good that you might have done for them and any good that might endure to you." And that became a principle in my life and still is a principle. I learned more from Lloyd Douglas in that book than I learned from a lot of life living.
Was that book a novel or was it nonfiction?
That book was still in pub, still around. He was a famous writer, Lord Douglas. But
was it fiction or nonfiction? Do you know?
I don't know if there's any fiction in writing. I think that all writers start out with a story of something that happened and they want to tell it and they make it a fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The Blackened Canteen is a story of real events written as historical fiction.
Right. Yeah, why don't we talk a little bit about that and about, we only have about 15 minutes left, but about each of your books, what they're about. So The Blackened Canteen is
an second book.
It's your second book.
The first book, I wanted my family to know the experience that I had that brought me to the deep hatred of in World War II of a whole nation of people, not one whom I had ever seen live, ever.
Wow.
And what happened when Robert married. That's the Warren wedding.
Yeah. Just before we move on from that, why do you think your son was so drawn to Japan?
Why do I think what?
That your son was so drawn to Japan. Robert, why was Robert so attracted to Japan?
When people want to perpetuate what they believe and who they are, and they want to occupy lands, the country of Japan has no natural resources, the country. And the military started in Korea or in Manchuria, I think 1935, 36, or 37, went to Manchuria. And it was the military who decided that they needed to become the greater Far East co-prosperity sphere, the army. And they were going to conquer all of the lands around them and have the natural resources. And that was a war of attrition. America fought one war of attrition against the American Indians. It was mm-hmm. a war of attrition for land, for profit, for growth, mm-hmm. for religious reasons. That's the one war that we fought, of attrition. There are other wars that we got back from, Spanish-American War and those kinds of things, that we got back, got territories. Mm. So, and then Germany, Hitler, the leader, wanted to be a thousand-year Reich, that the German people would dominate the rest of the world. So that was evil. And we fought in World War II. I fought because of a speech that was made in January by President Roosevelt's third election to the presidency, January of 1941, called the Four Freedoms Speech. And that Four Freedoms Speech should be heard by everybody. Mm. And the first freedom is the freedom of expression without fear of retribution for anything that you say all over the world. And the second is the ability to worship any god or no god without fear of retribution all over the world. And then the freedom from want. Everyone has a job, something to eat, somewhere to sleep, something to do, all over the world. And then the freedom from fear itself, the fear of being attacked by other countries. We should live without that fear. And that's what America was about then, the four freedoms. General MacArthur retired at a speech, with a speech at West Point called Duty, Honor, Country. Duty, Honor, Country. Mm. And that speech to the West Point should be read by every person, especially Americans. Duty on our country. The greatness of our country is the freedom. I was at every Memorial Day, I go to Washington, D.C., and on this particular Memorial Day, I was in the Navy auditorium at the Navy Memorial. And there were 400 people, 400 young 8th graders, 9th graders, who were going to march with a picture of a World War II veteran on Memorial Day called the Spirit of 45 Day. Day. And I looked out into the faces, and I saw the world. And it came to me, I was going to ask a question. How many of you in this audience, parents and teachers alike and students, are relatives somewhere way in the past of the American Indians and three or four children stood up. How many of you in the audience have members in their family way back who came to America on the Mayflower and those ships, and maybe a half a dozen kids stood up, or adults too? And how many of you in the audience have relatives that came to this country way back from another country, and everyone in the audience stood up? We're a nation of immigrants. And right now we're talking about immigration, building walls. We have to break down walls. The people that come to this country come because they can't work, and they do work that other Americans don't want to do. And immigration is necessary for our country. We're going through that right now.
Yeah, so, we sure are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to look at who we are. Years and years and years ago, people were leaving Seattle at such a rate, leaving Oregon and Seattle, and someone put a billboard up, with the last person who leaves Seattle, please turn out the lights. Big billboard. We don't want to put any billboards up about immigration. We need immigration.
Yeah, sure do.
So to get back now to in 2005, I went to Japan for the 60th anniversary of the bombing of Tokyo that killed a few hundred thousand Japanese citizens and made maybe 1.5 million homeless. And this was by National Public Television, NHK. And they interviewed me in Robert's house, in my son Robert's house. And a man by the name of Dr. Hiroyo Sugano saw that interview, heard Robert speaking English and Japanese, called Robert and asked him if he would come to a ceremony held on the Saturday closest to June 20th, because on June 20th, 1945, two B-29s crashed over Shizuoka, Japan, and two B-29s went down, and 23 Americans were killed. And this man, looking for body parts in the wreckage, discovered a canteen, an American canteen, with a handprint of the American in it that was holding it when he was incinerated, and he buried the Americans and was put in jail in June of 1945 for giving comfort to the enemy. When he got out, he had in his possession this canteen, and he became a Buddhist monk, and he created a monument on top of Mount Shizuhata in Shizuoka, Japan, where it says B-29 in English and the story in Japanese. And Dr. Sugano one day was walking in his hometown and saw a sign pointing to the monument, went up the monument, saw the monument, asked who did that, and he was sent to meet Mr. Fukumatsu Ito, who was the Buddhist priest. And they got in a conversation, and Dr. Sugano is now in possession of that blackened canteen. It's used in the ceremony every year, June, since 1948, where there's a ceremony honoring the dead of both communities, the Americans and the Japanese. When he was asked, why did he do that? Why did he bury the Americans? He said, the soul of people who die must be buried correctly. If they're not buried correctly within 50 years, they come back as they died. And I didn't want anybody coming back as a warrior again. Mm. And that's why he did that.
Mm-hmm.
In 2006, I went to that ceremony, and I was overwhelmed by what I saw. The American representatives were there, people from the academy were there, American military from Yokota Air Base were there, Japanese officials were there. The ambassador to Japan from America read a note, and I decided that I wanted to create a monument. I want to write a book and create a monument, put the 23 Americans' names up there.
Mm.
So I came back to Fairfield. I knew of Jim Belilov of Creative Edge, and I went to him and I said, Jim, what would it cost to build a monument with the names of 23 Americans, build it and ship it to Japan? He says, what are you talking about? And I told him a story. He says, well, I'll do that. You don't have to raise any money. I'll do that. So he created a monument. And in 2008, we went there together. and put that monument up on a Mount Shizuhata. And it's there with the 23 names of the Americans who were killed. One of the relatives, George O'Connor, whose father's brother was a bombardier, went to that ceremony, and a few other people whose family were involved went to that. And that monument's there forever. Jim's name is on it, and my name is on it. And I felt I had to tell that story, so I wrote The Blackened Canteen, a book. And then I wasn't liking America and what it was being promoted as by someone who was running for the presidency. So I started to write a book about what I thought America should be like. And I called it The Letter, right from the get-go. And it's a story of an American senator with gigantic power who hates blacks, Jews, and Catholics. Hates them all, vehemently. And he wants to officially make Christianity the language of America. And he's close to doing that. And then he gets a letter, or he gets knowledge of a letter from his daughter, whom he just let go because she married a Jewish guy and he hated the Jews, from a Catholic nun who confesses to being his mother of a Jewish father. So this senator is everything himself that he really hates. And that's the story of The Letter.
Oh, boy.
And how that evolved. And that's all from my creation. And I think it's, for me, it's my favorite book because it came all out of not anything that I'd ever seen or heard of.
Right,
or
right.
Done just from my
it's a novel.
Imagination. It's a novel.
It's a novel. And when was it published?
You know, I don't remember. It was published maybe 4 or 5 years ago. None of my books have ever done anything of note. My family all enjoyed them, I think. And then a couple of years ago,
I think other people have too.
I wrote about my experiences in The Resilient Warrior, Healing the Hidden Wounds of War.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that because we only have a few minutes left.
Well, I was working with the David Lynch Foundation and Bobby Roth asked me to write the book. Serena Grosswald, who was a scientist who's since passed away, and she wrote all of the documentary portions of the book about what TM can do. And I wrote about my experiences that gave me post-traumatic stress and my experiences of learning TM and how much it healed. Mm. I used the book one day four years ago when the headline on a Sunday Des Moines Register was a story about Luke Jensen, an Afghan soldier who came back and put a .45 to his head and tried to kill himself and was prevented from doing that. And he worked for the VA. And this was a two-page, three-page story in the Des Moines Register Sunday. And I called him up on Monday and told him who I was. Still works for the VA in Ames, Iowa. And I said, I'd like to send you a copy of my book. And I did. And then he and his wife came down and learned TM. And he got his life back.
Mm.
So it's useful.
And there are a number of people throughout the country who are teaching TM to veterans.
It's unknown to me. I don't know. I care, not for anything that would inure to me, but I care that that we don't do anything about with the science of the brain that we know about that creates zone experiences of nothingness and everything 20 minutes a day, twice a day, by meditating. They do mindfulness. Well, mindfulness doesn't cost anything. You can learn it from a book or you can learn it from a video, and it's the opposite of the silence that you get. You're creating thoughts and creating something in your head to take you somewhere else. And TM clears your head of all of that, even though you're awake and you hear everything and thoughts come and go about everything while you're meditating. It's a heartache for me. I think that I've been excluded from a number of positions of speaking. I won't mention by who, because the leadership are of a religious nature that believe that their prayers to their God takes care of everything. But I tell a story of a Scandinavian man standing in front of the black captain, thousands of men praying in front of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem at the ancient temple that was destroyed. And they're going back and forth saying prayers in Hebrew, and he's dumbfounded. And he taps on the shoulder of a man standing in back row. He says, "What are you all doing?" He says, "We're praying." "What are you praying for?" He says, "Well, I don't know what they're praying for, but I know what I'm praying here for." He says, "What are you praying for?" He says, "I'm praying for good health for my family, for the existence of Israel without going to war anymore, for prosperity for all people in the world." And the Scandinavian guy says, "Does it help? Does prayer help?" He says, "It's like talking to a wall." So there are examples of things that you can do for yourself. Transcendental meditation is one of them. It's the best thing that happened to me outside of my marriage and my children. It's the best thing that happened to me at 92.
Wow. So it's kind of amazing to me how much you're traveling at your age, because I get worn out when I travel as much as it sounds like you're doing. So where are you heading next?
I'm going to Galesburg, Illinois, to speak to the Stearman Association of America on Labor Day. On the 6th, I'm going back to Fairfield. On the 8th of September, I'm going to a space shoot. On the 22nd of September, I'm coming back to Fairfield because on the 25th, I'm speaking to the North Library, either the museum or the library in North Liberty, Iowa. Then I'm going home. And then on the 6th of October, I'm flying to San Antonio for the 5th Marine Division Convention, and on and on.
And how do all these arrangements get made? Do you have somebody
People ask me, and I say yes.
Wow. And if someone wants to contact you, how do you
They
how
contact
do they
me on the internet. Some people know me. They
Why don't we give your website again in case somebody wants to contact you? It's CaptainJerryYellen.com.
CaptainJerryYellen.com is the website. And
what a memory. What a memory. I can't even remember what I did yesterday. I mean, gosh, that's amazing that you can remember all those things. It's just amazing.
When I went to the doctor a couple of weeks ago, I said, "Doc, I've got a problem." He says, "What's your problem?" I say, "As soon as I say something, I forget what I said." He said, "How long has that been going on?" I said, "How long has what been going on?"
Oh, that's a good one.
Life is just a blessing for me.
That's great.
I'm just like...
Well, we're very grateful that you were able to join us here today.
Yes, thank you very
honor,
much.
It's my honor, my pleasure.
Yeah,
thank you so much
love,
for having
love
me.
Hearing your stories.
Amen.
And recommend The Blackened Canteen, Of War and Weddings, The Letter. Now, I want to read The Letter.
Yes.
That's The Resilient Warrior.
They're all available on Amazon.com.
Great. And probably some of them are at Revelations if you're here in town.
They had them. I don't think they have them anymore.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay. But they can always order things.
They can
things.
Order them, yeah.
Now,
just for the audience, there's a lunch tomorrow. I'd love to meet the people that I know. There's a lunch at Revelations at 12:30.
That's September 3rd.
Tomorrow,
12:30 Saturday. 12:30 at Revelations.
And if anybody listens to your show and wants to come, I'd love to see you.
Oh, that's wonderful. And, of course, this is weekend for FairFest, so there's going to be a lot going on downtown this weekend. Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. How I wish some public figures would do this. Just to see how it feels for the next 24 hours, refrain from criticizing anybody or anything.
Wow. Thank you, Jerry, for being with us. And stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore if you're listening on Friday. And our rebroadcast is Monday morning, 8 a.m. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU LP 100.1 FM. produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.